We have a very special format. And now Peggy will give us a brief history of the group and bloopers, followed by information break, and then our main speaker will speak for 45 minutes. So please help me welcome our founder, Peggy.
Hello, my name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. Early in 1994, when I mentioned to Clancy that we were starting a group and we were going to call it the Atlantic Group, Clancy said, you know, if you make it, I'll come for your first anniversary. And he's graciously returned for all of them. And tonight is, of course, our 12th. Thank you. Thank you, Clancy. And now a little history. Most groups, as you know, start with a resentment and a coffee pot. The Atlantic Group did not. Started with a dream. And, of course, the enthusiasm of the Pacific Group and its founder, Clancy. And I've been blessed with being one of the founders, along with Van, who, without a doubt, Atlantic Group shepherd. And Norman, who shared our humble beginnings. The fellowship that we chose 12 years ago has grown up around us. Our big book makes that promise. It was March 1st, 1994, and we met for the first time on 91st Street and 5th Avenue at the Convent of the Sacred Heart. I had scouted that location, and the reason I picked it was because it had red velvet chairs and gold gilded frames. I mean, it was beautiful. Now, of course, it's a private girls' school, and they forgot that they had rented us the space and put us, we were supposed to have the recital hall, and instead they gave us the library, which seated 40 comfortably. We were 75 that night. So Atlantic Group's first lesson, we adapt to change and we are mobile. In our fifth year, very interestingly, they came to us and said, you can only have 75. And please, after the 75th person, you must bar the door. And we said, booze can keep them out. We can't. And so the hunt began for a new home for the Atlantic Group. Lots of prayers later, on June 29th, 1999, Christ Church took us in. And we have been happily ensconced here since then. We also have five other meetings. We have a Thursday beginners meeting upstairs on the fourth floor. We have our 11-step meditation meeting at the Karen Foundation on East 58th Street. Our big book meets at Marymount on Wednesdays. Our Steps in Tradition meets on the west side every Friday at the Universalist Church. And our call-up meeting meets on Sunday at the Veterans Administration. Six meetings a week and growing. You know, I will not say that this is the best group because that would sound like bragging instead of the unvarnished truth. But whatever we are, it is because of our members' actions. You are the living examples of recovery, unity, and service. God has blessed us, and I know these blessings will continue. Yesterday, when I was putting this together, a little script in script form, I came across an email that Van sent me 2 years ago. And his note was, we're getting ready for the 10th anniversary, Peggy, and maybe you could incorporate some of my feelings into your history talk. I'd like to add those words tonight. I will tell you why I believe that we're 12 years old. Enough of you are willing to give up while you attend an Atlantic Group meeting, your personal desires, your needs, even your demands. Give up your individual, may I say, rights, because you follow, consciously or not, the first tradition. The group comes first, the individual second, albeit a close second. That you are obedient to avoiding the use of street language. You dress according to our dress code, and you follow another tradition, our primary purpose, carrying the message of AA. It is you, the individual member, from the newest of newcomers to the eldest of elders, being loving and tolerant of your group. That's what makes it work. And it is because of your sacrifice that we are here tonight. And if you keep that up, if you remain true to the group conscience, retain the structure, follow the traditions, you'll be meeting 20, 30, and maybe even more years and fill this room with AA music. Laughter and sharing and love for one another. Our fellowship, loving our fellowship, and especially our group. Okay, and now for some funny stuff. Some bloopers and bleepers that were actually heard here at the podium at the Atlantic Group. Made a searching and fearless and moral inventory of others. Please help me spank the speaker. That was just like 2 weeks ago. Our lovers are but trusted servants. Sought through prayer and medication to improve contact. And this is a very popular one. Is the watch a Rolex? Our fear of police will leave us. And the feeling of usefulness will disappear. And now may I introduce to you last year's chairperson, Stacy.
My name is Stacy. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Fun part. Our seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. The baskets will now be passed. All right. Our main speaker tonight is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be at the 12th anniversary when Peggy and Van and Marlena and Norman started this meeting all these years ago. And I knew them, and I didn't think between them they had enough brains to start a meeting. But I was partially wrong. We don't know if it's going to run forever. It's only going to, sure, run 12 years. But anyway, I'm very glad to be here. I said I'd be here for their first anniversary, and I was pleased to come here, and I've been pleased to come here ever since. We have kind of a routine. I come into town, and yesterday I had a pleasant afternoon. Well, not pleasant, but I had an interesting afternoon. I sat at the hospital with Van for a few hours, and last evening we went to a show and had dinner together, and it was a very pleasant. We talked about AA and talked about, it's just been very good to get back here. I like this group. It has a spirit very similar to my home group in Los Angeles. Bob, the young man from, where's that, hitting bottom capital of the world? He has started a group in Las Vegas called the Specific Group. And we all laughed and smirked, and now it's the largest and most successful meeting in Las Vegas. And he's the Peggy of Las Vegas. Except he's not allowed to read histories at their anniversaries. Just a question. I didn't hear anybody ask this. Just for my own satisfaction. How many people here are in their first year of sobriety? A lot. Jeez. Well, no. I don't want you to clap for them. They don't deserve it. But the reason I think about that is because so often people come to AA and we, after a while, assume that you know what we know, you kind of get lost in the shuffle. And I wanted to go a little bit to that anniversary and I talk a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous and its kind of entry. You know, there seems to be, most people in this room know this, but you new people may not know this. There seems to be different types of alcoholics. Nobody talks about it much, but there are types of alcoholics. There's a type of alcoholic who, by any way you measure them, drinks, can't stop drinking, has troubles, and something happens that really threatens his or her security. Maybe they lose a job or lose a family or it's a death in the family or something. And they quit. And they never drink again. And most of us know people who used to drink and quit and never drank again. Then there's another type of person, much the same type as that, except they have become physically addicted to alcohol. If you're new, you may not be aware that physical addiction to alcohol is much more lethal than physical addiction to drugs. The withdrawal is deadly. You go to convulsions and death many times. And these are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created. And these people are alcoholics by any way you measure them. They drink and have trouble. And something happens that threatens their security. And they go to a treatment center. And they're medically withdrawn. That's why treatment centers were created, to medically withdrawn alcoholic addicts who are addicted to alcohol. And each step of the way, they get a lesson about the chaos in their lives, and they quit. And they never drink again. There's a big hospital in Seattle called Schick Shadel that caters to these people. And they advertise, "We will cure your alcoholism in 1 month." Which sounds funny to us, but they do it. They have lists of names that don't stop of people who've come there. Alcoholics of that type. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by the way you measure them. They drink and have troubles and something happens that threatens their security and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same people come out of treatment centers all over the world with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. "Yes, I quit. No more." But eventually they always drink again. And these are the type of alcoholics that have baffled everyone for 5,000 years of written history. They baffled those who in the science field, they baffled religion, they baffled medicine, they baffled. If you're like me, the bafflement is usually a great deal of it is at home. I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room who've had the experience I've had, looking at the face of someone who's just contorted with sorrow. They're saying, "Oh, how could you? How could you? You promised. You were doing so well, and now look at you. How could you do this?" And it makes you feel so bad, and the only answer to it is, "Shut up and leave me alone, goddammit!" Because I feel so bad, I don't know what to do about it. Which is not... You think that's funny, huh? Go talk to my wife. She doesn't think it's funny. But it really is. And these are the type of people that are so baffling. And they're the people who don't stay sober. And those are the people that Bill Wilson in our book writes about. He talks to me, he doesn't say about alcoholics of our type. He says, again and again, people of alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type are people who will not stay sober, who cannot indefinitely stay sober. They can for a while, but they can't. And that's what makes Alcoholics Anonymous such a remarkable thing, because there are people here staying sober that has never happened in human history before. Just think, in all of history of treating people like us, there's been two brief periods where there's ever been any success. One was in 1840. Six guys got together in a bar in Baltimore. One was just out of jail. And he's telling his friend, "Jesus, those people down there, that chaplain said he knows how I feel." "He didn't know how I feel. Nobody knows how I feel except you five guys." They all agreed. They all understood how each other felt. "But this drinking is killing us. What the hell are we going to do?" And they decided to form an organization to help each other stay sober. Silly. They had the election and they elected officers, five officers. We identify with number six, I'm sure. But people laughed and said, you can't keep yourself sober. You're gonna, what a joke is this? But they stayed sober. And some people came down from Philadelphia and saw this, and they went back to Philadelphia and started a little group too. They called themselves the Washingtonians after the Washington, they were patriotic. And a little group came down from Boston. Boston really took off. They had a big success up there, and people from Philadelphia and Washington, all these. And at the end of the year, they had a number of people staying sober in all these towns, and nobody could understand why. Eccentric, crazy fools. And they go into the second year. By now, they'd gone into most of the states. They started in early March. So they decided to take Washington's birthday as their anniversary, February 22nd, not too far off, give it a little panache. And just before their second anniversary, they wrote to all the groups they knew of in existence. and said, you know, people still think we're weird and eccentric. What you ought to do is have someone from your community who's got maybe some young person who's not a big shot yet, but is on the coming up, and have him talk to us. Not because we care what he says, but so that he will tell people they're not as crazy as we thought. So all over the country on February 22nd, all of people came in and talked to the Washingtonians. In Springfield, Illinois, the young guy they chose was Abraham Lincoln. If you read a book of Lincoln's speeches, you'll find a speech to the Washingtonians. And he really had an amazing insight. He said, you people, I know you well. You're sensitive and good friends of mine. The only thing I don't understand about you, I don't understand your thirst. I don't have that thirst. But you certainly are doing well, and on and on. And it continued to grow. Now, it's amazing when you stop and think there was no telephones, no radios, no television, obviously, no nothing. Everyone that stayed sober was one-to-one, one-to-one. There was no... And what made them grow tremendously in their third year, what public entertainment was usually just mass meetings. They'd have speakers come in and give a long, rousing talk. That's how people entertained. And they got two or three of these guys into the Washingtonians. They were drunks and got sober. And so they began talking to large groups about the Washingtonians. And they just plummeted in. They just came in. By 1845, they estimated the membership of the Washingtonians was about 100,000 sober drunkards. Now, that may not be impressive to you, but AA, with all of its facilities, didn't have 1,000 people after 5 years. And then they did something in 1845 that seemed reasonable to them, because it seems reasonable to AA now. Members in AA think the same way. Gee, if we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people with other problems. We should be able to help people with narcotic problems who aren't drinkers. Not heroin and cocaine like today, but laudanum and opium, which they used then. We should help people with emotional problems. We should help stamp out the sale of alcohol. We called it temperance, but it really was prohibition. Because if there wasn't any alcohol to be sold, no one would drink. And some of us got involved in anti-slavery movement. And some got involved in getting Texas into the Union. I mean, all people just went to work and just tremendous put their forces behind these things. By 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct and nearly all of them died drunk. I had a book home written by a member in 1861. He said, it was just hard to understand what happened. He said, we were doing so well and then people got so busy, they didn't have time to go to meetings. They were so busy on so many other things. And one by one, they just all left and I guess they got drunk. I don't know. I'll tell you how extinct they became when Bill Wilson founded AA and for years thereafter. He'd never heard of it. He never heard of it. And it wasn't until the early 1940s, we had a big explosion, you know, when they had this Reader's Digest article in 1941. A lot of people, for the first time, heard there were places for people, drunkards like I have in my house, to stay sober. And so they all rode into AA and meetings started all over the country, just like flowers blooming in the desert. But two years later, they were all dying off again. And Bill Wilson sat in his office month after month, seeing our group just died, take us off your meeting list, and our members don't want to do this anymore, and they got fighting over how we should do it, and on and on. And by 1944, AA was heading towards extinction, it looked like, someday in the future. And Bill Wilson was desperately trying to save it. He didn't know what to do. He thought, I'll start a newspaper. That'll help. But he started the Grapevine in the shape of a tabloid about the shape of the Daily News. And they started that. That helped a little, not much. And in 1945, a guy in North Carolina submitted an article for the Grapevine. He said, Bill, you ought to read this. It's really interesting. It was the story of the Washingtonians. Bill had never heard of it. He read that story and thought, my God, it's like AA. And he went to the library and found what he could find and saw what had happened to the Washingtonians and their battles and their fights and their difficulties. And he sat down and thought, what can I do? And in the desperate effort to save our lives, although he knew none of us, I mean, for the future, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions. And the 12 traditions were based on what made the Washingtonians fail and what was making AA fail. And he They wrote them in the long form, not the short form that we read tonight. Some of you don't know about the long form, but in the back of the book there's a short form, and then there's a long form, which is really the 12 traditions. They just abbreviated them for the short form. Make it a little easier to read, I guess. In my home group in Los Angeles, we read the long form on the second Wednesday of every month, so that all the newcomers can understand what the hell we're talking about. But anyway, he issued these new traditions one by one in the grapevine. And there's only one problem. AA had the same problem in 1945 and 46 that they have now. There seems to be no way to get around it. It's full of alcoholics. And most people refuse the traditions. We don't want any traditions! We don't want rules and laws! We're here for love, goddammit! Now stop it! You know. And people started his campaign. Bill Wilson started his campaign. You see pictures of him on his motorcycle? He went to groups all over the East Coast trying to, on his motorcycle with Lois Wilson in the sidecar, trying to explain the traditions are necessary for our saving. It got to a point, and I'm sure that some of our friends from the World Service Office know this, of course, because it's from their archives. Letters written from people, Connecticut, Bill, we'd love to have you come and speak at our second anniversary. Unless you plan to speak about the traditions, then stay home. I mean, it sounds funny now, but it wasn't funny then. It was really brutal. And by 1949, they could see that battles going on, groups still dying, some flourishing, some accepted it, some, but there were all sorts of things going on. And there was such an antagonism. For example, the people at A's in Chicago hated New York, and they would only communicate with the people in Akron. The people in Los Angeles had nothing to do with Akron, only with the people in New York. All over, people in Florida wouldn't contact anybody. They just... dummies. That's why they're the way they are now. I'm not judging them. I'm just reporting. But all over the country, fights and arguments still going on. And so Bill, and there was a great deal of antipathy between the people in Akron and the people in New York. Because the people in Akron were a little more still in the Oxford movement, a little more religious, a little more four absolutes, absolute honesty, absolute open-mindedness, absolute, which sounds very nice, but for most of us, I can't do anything absolutely, so I don't even try. And in New York, it was more of an action-oriented, get out there and get involved. And so Bill and Dr. Bob, the two co-founders, the co-founder in Akron, Dr. Bob Smith, and here Bill Wilson, got together and said, we've got to somehow bring these warring elements together. Get maybe some people from Los Angeles and Chicago and Houston, where there's a kind of a live wire group, Florida, up and down, Philadelphia, all of, just Seattle. If we could just get people all these places in one room, we could explain to them. And so they said to their followers, find us a place to meet. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting, but we won't go to New York, so just forget that. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we'll go to a meeting, we'll go to that Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and they came up with the Solomon-like decision, Cleveland. Okay, we'll all go to Cleveland. So on the July 4th weekend of 1950, the largest group of sober alcoholics of our type that ever sat in a room together were sitting in Cleveland having what they called an international convention. I still have the program for that. And in fact, when we came to the international convention, I gave all the people from our group a copy of that program. It's very short. And most of the speakers are an alcoholic because they were still more convinced in trying to communicate to people who were not weird, because the warden of San Quentin was the main speaker, the government, people explaining how much AA had helped their facilities. But Bill and Dr. Bob talked, and Dr. Bob was dying of cancer by this time. So they said, you probably don't want to talk, Bob. He said, oh, I've got to talk. He said, I'm sober 15 years next to Bill. There's nobody in the history of the world who's been sober as long as I have. So on that day, his son on one side and his friend on the other side took this tall, gaunt, sick man and led him to the podium. And he gave a talk, which many people conceive to be one of the great moments of alcoholic history. In fact, if you go to the World Service Office as you go in, you'll see it on the wall. It's still there. It's a great talk. I love it. I have copies of it. I have copies of that whole convention on tape. It's really great. The quality of the tapes are bad, but the quality of the content is wonderful. But he got up there, and nobody was going to say it. He said, well, I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I want you to go back and tell the boys and girls in your group. They left that off that in your office, by the way, that little phrase. All the boys and girls in your group, that we're all here for the same reason. We all do the same things. We all get out of what AA, what we put into it. He said, as I look over this vast crowd, he said, I'm glad that some small thing I did 15 years ago helped bring this about. He said, I want to apologize for my health. I've been in bed most of the past few months. I thought my health would return faster. But just the usual talk you'd expect. But then he said, but I want to call your attention to two or three things that I think may be of interest. And then he talked and gave as good a definition of what we are here for as ever been said anywhere. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding and tolerance. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who does know exactly what he's talking about. We're all so gracious and loving when things are going our way. Yes, I just got a raise and work, everything's going well. Get engaged to a new beautiful girl. Oh, that A really works. But let somebody hurt my feelings or threaten my security and cut, slash, cut, burn. And finally, he said, none of us would be here tonight if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we are too busy to help our brother who is still suffering from this disease. Thank you, and sat down and was dead shortly thereafter. Very great movement. But also at that convention, they had six young guys. They gave them each two traditions. I don't know what they looked like at all, but you could just hear their tails wagging. They were just excited at this. I want to tell you about this tradition, Joe. And they explained the traditions are not laws. If you're new, they're not laws. We can't punish you. You can break them if you want to. You can break every tradition and still come and sit in the meeting. We can't keep you out. You're welcome here. There are no AA police. Although I must say, some of us feel that's a shortcoming. In my area, as unfair as it seems like, I have been referred to as a dictator-type sponsor. No reason for it. I have three or four people in this room who I sponsor, and if you ask them, they'll say, But I have to explain to people, you can only have a dictatorship as long as the dictatee wants to. All they ever have to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. That's why it'd be nice if we had a group who could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us to the camp for a little training. But anyway, they read these traditions, and they were voted in. And I'll tell you something else. This is a funny little secret. This is a secret, but it's not very well known. After all this, Bill Wilson was not sure how they would vote, I believe. Because he got up after they were read and said, now we've all heard the traditions. Seeing no objections, we accept them. But he realized strong actions were necessary for the preservation of AA, and they saved AA. It's only problems now that sometimes in some areas the traditions are just kind of funny things they give newcomers to read to see if they can pronounce autonomous. But groups that do not follow the traditions go down. There's an old truism. A meeting where anything goes is eventually a meeting where nobody goes. The tradition, the one I always think of in New York, I hope I don't offend you by talking about this, but 25 or 30 years ago, I was brought into New York to talk to the Midtown Group, the largest group in the state. Great group. And I did that several times. The last time I was there, they had decided that AA was a little too repressive. It was now half AA and half NA. And we'll have everybody participate. It's all one big disease. And the Midtown Group, within a short time, was extinct. The largest group in the state. Because people didn't want to go there anymore. They listen to that. Incidentally, let me tell you in passing, if you're new, that's a phrase you'll hear sometime these days. It's all one big disease. Do you know where that phrase comes from? It came from a treatment center that only had one van. Yeah. And the reason that it is imperative is this, is because the nature of our disease is such, and most of us don't find this out and won't listen to it until we almost die. I was in and out of AA for 10 years because I was too intellectual for this simple crap. And I'll tell you, I understand slipping. I started off as a high-bottom drunk, and the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in Los Angeles with my teeth kicked out and everything gone, and there was not a soul in the world would accept a collect phone call from me. And I would have bet that day, but AA can't help people like me. My case is different. The universal cry of all of us. But what makes AA so important? What has been so difficult to get through to people like us? Why do people like me die? And you, some of you. It's because the problem here is so... I think the bottom line has always been something that we don't hardly ever talk about except in passing. It's the feeling that you have had and may still have, and I have had and at times have. My case is different. That's all. My case is different. I know you mean well. I know you try to help me with this stuff, but my case is different. And that wall will effectively block out any help you get from anybody. You know, one of the great things we talk about, getting good advice. There isn't a person in this room who hasn't had enough advice to last them 10,000 years. From everybody. Everybody gives people like us advice. Families, friends, counselors, passers-by. Here's what you ought to do. And really, just after a while, you just learn to shine it off, you know. Gee, thanks. I really appreciate it. You asshole. Yeah. And how do you get through that wall? No one's ever been able to do it. And it started a long time ago when this goof Bill Wilson, sober a little while, got a job finding what to Akron and put it together a deal, and he blew it up. And he was an Oxford woman, and he started to have a drink. I stood in the hotel lobby he stood in many years later and tried to recreate that feeling. I've lost the deal. I got to go back to New York and show I'm a failure again. My wife is going to be disappointed in me. I'll never work. And over there is a room with a curved little sign over it saying cocktails. And he reached in his pocket. He had a $10 bill. I can either pay off the hotel or catch a train home. What'll I do? I can't do both. And the next thought he had is something that I identify with. I'm sure you do too. I'll just have a drink or two and think of something. And right there, your life and mine hung by a thread that thin, you'll never guess. But it turned out he saw some telephones. He promised the Oxford group he'd talk to somebody. And through a series of labyrinthian calls, he got a hold of some drunken doctor. And he went out to talk to this doctor. And the doctor didn't want to hear about it because he was a drunk too. And his wife said, "We want to take you out to the lady's house and meet this man from here." He said, I don't want to listen to that. He didn't want to hear about it any more than any of us ever wanted to get lectured at. His son was a friend of mine. And he said, driving his dad out there, listening to his father talk to his mother. "And I'll give this guy 20 minutes, but I'm not going to give him any more. I'm not going to listen to this. I've had enough lectures from people. If I could do something about it, I would." And they went out there and he went into this room with this Bill Wilson. And he was in there 4 hours. And came out a different man. He said, "My God, Ann, I don't know how to tell you this. That's the first person I ever met who seems to know how I feel and why I drink. I can't believe it. And he said to Bill, could you possibly stay with us a couple of weeks and talk about this? And Bill, let's see, I have no way to get out of town. Yes, I can. And that was the start of our thing. They tried us for a couple of weeks talking about spiritual matters. The doctor got drunk, so they realized talking about spiritual matters isn't what had kept Bill sober. It was trying to help others. So they went up to the Akron Hospital and got a third guy. That's kind of interesting. They got this guy. Here's the same thing. I heard him talk many years ago. So I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. He was a drunken lawyer from Louisville who went to Akron to get rid of his alcoholism, which obviously didn't work. I was laying in that bed. My wife said to me, two fellows want to talk to me about my drinking. And I thought, oh, hell. I'm sick of people talking to me about my drinking. But my wife's a mighty strong woman. So I talked to them fellas. And they never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt. And I couldn't believe my ears. I never heard anybody describe me like that before. I was so impressed. I stuck with them fellas. I've been with them ever since. Number three. Then they lost some because they tried to preach too much religion. It turned out later. I just want to say something for a lot of young people here. They finally got a young guy in. Not young in our standards, but young in their standards. 29. And they're kind of pleased. Oh, a young man. And he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And brought AA. It wasn't AA then. It's still part of the Oxford movement. But our antecedency brought us our first relationship. I don't know of a single word that sends a shudder down a sponsor's spine more than that word. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh. What you really need is a machine on your desk that just says, uh-huh, uh-huh. And they say inspiring things like, oh, I know, I thought the last girl was the one, but I swear to God, when I saw this girl walking out of detox, I just knew she was... They got married. Isn't that wonderful? I'll tell you, that happened in my family many years later. My youngest daughter, Susan, fell in love with a guy named, I won't even mention his name. I wasn't in favor of their marriage, but we have a lot of women in our family, and I was outvoted. But they got married, and I want to give you the absolute textbook definition of mixed emotions. It's watching your daughter walk down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything, but you can give hints. You could say, let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. So Bob's daughter married this guy, and they thought, you know, you shouldn't be running around like this. You got a new bride. You should stay home and take care of her and take care of your home, and we'll take care of all this other stuff, going to the Oxford group meetings and trying to help people. So they were kind of upset when he got drunk and died and turned her against AA for the next 50 years. She hated AA for the next 50 years. Always attacking it when she had a chance. She finally came around. But anyway, they got enough people, little by little, and Bill came back to New York, started a little pocket here, and that's how it all began. But it has always been one thing. People have, whether they know it or not, in their telling their story, doing these things, 12-stepping, the way to get through that wall is to make that person feel they are not as different as they feel they are. To make them understand there are people who fell the same. Every deal in AA, really, consists of one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help them lower their feelings of difference at least enough so they will begin to take actions they do not yet believe in. And that is the secret of the gestation of sobriety, of beginning to take actions. I know I slipped in and out for Los Angeles, as I say, for AA all over the country. In Los Angeles, I really down and out. I was living in an abandoned car in the A Club parking lot, and people were shunning me as they should have. But I fell into the hands of a guy who began to He said, talk to me. And I've tried to talk to him. I thought he'd give me some razzmatazz crap religion or God or something. And he really talked sense to me. And I began to feel, God, this guy seems to know how I feel. Which in a Rotary meeting wouldn't mean much. But you and I know. I never met anybody who I thought knew how I felt. My dad didn't. My doctor didn't. My psychiatrist didn't. My employers didn't. They all said they did. I know how you feel. And you have to say, gee, thanks. But you just want to say, no, you don't know how I feel. Leave me alone. But I would tell him things and I would admit my weaknesses sometimes, which was a big breakthrough. Strong people seem to be able to talk about their weaknesses. Weak people hate to, because that's all I got. But he would tell me things to do, and I would gradually begin to believe that he... And that's what I... And when he would tell me things, that's when advice becomes meaningful information. And he tells me things to do that I would never do, except I believe in him. I remember standing at the Brentwood meeting with him, which was only six blocks away from where later on O.J. wouldn't kill his wife. We didn't know it then, but we sensed it somehow. But we were standing there, and he said, see the woman over there? I said, yes. I have no teeth, front teeth, so I talk right. Yeah, I see her, Bob. Why? I want you to apologize to her. Are you kidding? I don't like her at all. I'm not going to apologize. Why should I apologize to her? It was told to me that at a meeting the other night, you called her a bitch. I said, Bob, she is a bitch. So, why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girls to stay away from me. Well, she's right. You apologize. Anybody else in the world, I don't care who it was, I'd have said, to hell with you. You want to apologize? You go apologize. I'm not going to abase myself by talking to that fat old bag. But it was somebody that I believed in. I found myself going, bitch. He got me to stay on jobs I would have quit. He would have got me to go to meetings I didn't want to go to because they cheated me badly. And little by little, I began to have a great confidence in him. Little by little. And I finally got a job that I held when I was 2 years sober. Still didn't have any front teeth. And I had to carry my lip like this. People just thought I'd been burned in a fire. But I did things. They hurt my feelings. When my feelings are hurt, that's when I run. I get mad or I explode. And I'd call Bob. Bob, this guy said this to me, and I'm going to punch him in the face and get out of here. He said, no, that's what you do at all. Here's what you do. Some stupid thing. And I'd do it, and it'd work. Boy, I worked out a deal, Bob. Yeah. And by the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that big medical corporation. I had teeth then, smiled a lot. If you're new tonight and have lost teeth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. By the time I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. And things were just going great. And then, unfortunately, then things took a turn in my head. Trouble with AA, you keep doing these things, and things look different, and you can't tell what's going to turn out. When I was 15 years sober, one day I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 32 years, as of last week, I've been the managing director of the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you want to go back to that damn mission when you had a great career? And I can't think of a good answer. Well, with such a significant decrease in salary, I didn't want to pass it up. I'm still looking for those two bastards that threw me out. Once I get them, I'll be out. I don't know. But tomorrow morning, when I catch a plane, by noon tomorrow, when you're having lunch, I'll be stepping over the bodies of dead, dying men and women and children in the streets of Los Angeles, going to my office to see if we can find some way to keep them going. We're not a treatment center. We're way below that. We're just trying to keep people alive. But the point is, Alcoholics Anonymous seems to be predicated on the purpose of action. And we keep thinking, to stop drinking is going to make it better. And that's the other thing I had to learn. If you're new tonight, I want to tell you that is not true. Stopping drinking makes it worse. Because the problem here is not alcohol. I remember hearing my sponsor say, but I mean, when he's saying something, he says, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. I thought, oh, Jesus. You're embarrassing me, Bob. Don't talk that stupid. You know, alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol. They come to AA, admit their problem is alcohol, and then they feel better, and they return to God, and they live better. So that's not it at all, kid. That's why you have so much trouble. That's why you don't stay sober. Because you think your problem isn't alcohol. You don't know that you're right. Of course, Bob. What are you talking about? He said, let me tell you something. The problem here is not alcohol, but we would all be home free. I said, what is the problem, Bob? Psychocybernetics? What is it? He says, no, it's something that sounds like alcohol, but it isn't. Tremendously different. It is called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. You know, alcoholism. Hooray, I'm cured. You know. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me a long talk over a period of a couple of days about that. Most of it I've just shunted through my head and got rid of it as fast as I could. But a little bit of it stayed, and that stage changed my life. And if you're new tonight, I want you to if you hear nothing else I said tonight, remember this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and living soberly thereafter. However, in this, those are the kind of people that get cured at Chic Chadel. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, nobody ever explained that way. They all say, get sober, you're going to feel better. And I don't. He said, that's right. That's because your problem isn't alcohol. It's alcoholism. Why are you holding up those signs with numbers on? I don't even know what they mean. 50 minutes? That seems awfully long time. And I said, well, if that's the case, Bob, then how do you overcome it? Why do these people keep drinking if it does so terrible things to them? He says, you don't drink because it does terrible things to you. You drink because it does wonderful things for you. The thing that makes an alcoholic is that you get an unusual reaction. I say, yeah, I know that. He says, the unusual reaction is not that you keep drinking all the time. It's that when I drink, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. When I drink, it almost instantly changes my relationship to the world around me. When I drink, I become taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less threatening. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? He says, because it isn't really happening, you idiot. It's in your head. He says, that's why people drink. And he says, this phenomenon of craving comes along. I don't understand that. Nobody ever understands that. And there never has been an explanation of this phenomenon of craving. But I have an explanation for my phenomenon of craving, I think, at least the theory. And that is when things are bad and you're tense and crushed, it needs a few couple drinks, it almost instantly changes things. And then you start to sag and you almost instantly have another drink to hold it. And you have another drink to hold it. You see old guys sometimes so drunk they can't walk. Give me a drink. You want to say, you don't need a drink. Yes, they do. They're trying to keep them going back. They're sagging. Give me a drink. And eventually you get sober. I said, okay, I understand that, Bob, but now they're sober again. Why would they drink now? Why would they drink now, for God's sakes? Well, they know it's good to eat them up. He said, that's the other part of the disease, kid. That's what makes alcoholism. And he had a theory that I've never been able to find a hole in it. He said, when people are born and grow up, you go through a lot of problems. You learn cope with problems, situations to deal with, things you like, things you don't like. You learn conflicts in life that you can avoid or cope with, problems that you have to learn to solve. And you get through these things. If you do all that, you become what's known as a mature individual. You become mature. And mature individuals live very comfortably in the world. They know what to get along. They know how to get along with people. They get along with their kids. They get along with their neighbors. They hold jobs. They're friendly with one another. They do all, you know. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. I said, why not, Bob? He said, because when we have long-term problems or painful situations, we drink and get rid of them. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Here's to you, Mr. Collins. Take your job and shove it in your ear, will you? And when I don't know that I'm doing these things, I'm building up a closet of unsolved problems and emotional reactions. So the day must come, as it does for people like us, where we say, okay, enough. I've screwed around enough. I've watched disappointment in my kids' eyes. I've disappointed my family. I lost jobs that I should have kept. I should have been president of the company. And they're treating me, I'm tired of that. I'm going to bear down now. I'm going to really do a good job. And never once know it is impossible. It cannot happen. Because sooner or later, my emotions will be kicked up. And I will be at the beck and call of unsolved childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little more nice. But they're childish emotions. You hurt my feelings. I quit. I'm going to show you. I hate you. I love you. Let's run away. Let's get married. And pretty soon you get out of whack and you get feeling very bad. Some doctors say you get to a point where you literally must drink to preserve your sanity. And you drink till you get sober. And you have to stay sober till you have to drink. Then you drink till you have to stay sober. And every time you go back and forth, your head says, but see, alcohol wasn't the problem at all. It's all these other things. People don't understand. Your case is different. You have sensitivities. You need love. You need something. These people can't provide it. Have another drink. That's why most people like us die drunk. Most of us, well over 90% of alcoholics of our type in America still die drunk. And you and I are so lucky to be sitting in these rooms. The curse of it all is that our mind will find reasons to get us out of here. You don't need it. Oh, come on, these people hurt your feelings. But that's what this is about. And that day I told Bob, my God, I never heard anybody describe my life better than that. He said, there's a name for people like you. I said, what could it be, Bob? He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, my God, I am an alcoholic. That's what I am. I've just spent 10 years throwing away my life, threw away my family, threw away big opportunities, threw golden chances, and wind up living in an abandoned car without front teeth because I could not find a thing that made me think I was an alcoholic. All right, Bob, Jesus, why doesn't AA describe it the way you do? There's all this obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body, crap. He says, they do, kid. Look up there on the wall. He says, the first step, ask you to admit you're having some problems with alcohol. Then there's a dash, meaning end of thought, beginning of new thought. And you have to admit you're having some problems without alcohol. That's all. And if you're new tonight, that's all you have to admit. And if you couldn't admit that, you wouldn't be here. Because if you could still drink, you'd be out drinking. So would I. If you could stay sober comfortably, you'd be outside staying sober comfortably, do something else. It's when you can do neither that you're driven to rooms like this and listen to your head say, you don't belong here, your case is different. But that's what it's about here, little by little, to come to believe that and hopefully find someone, a sponsor, that you can listen to and respect enough to allow him or her to superimpose judgments over your emotional chaos. And if you do that little by little, you work through it. Nothing ever says it's terribly easier, but it sure is simpler than the alternative. So that's why it's kind of nice to get together like this. We're celebrating 12 years of a meeting full of people who, by any stroke of judgment, should not be sober tonight, or should be sober but sick or desperate or in a treatment center or laying at home in bed vomiting. That's where we belong. You and I have a tendency, I do especially, have a tendency to forget how lucky we are to have been born, through no merit of mine or yours, born in the only window